I want first to express my deep appreciation to the committee and the faculty for the invitation. As any scholar knows, this kind of invitation is inspiring and stimulating to him more than to anyone else because it forces rethinking and new work in that field. And so it's really a gift to me that you made me do some work, which I probably would otherwise not have done. Thank you very much. And to all the rest of you, students and visitors, for your kind participation and attention and interest in the subject. I've enjoyed my time here very much, and it's gone too rapidly, but that is in the nature of things. When Brother Fast mentioned that this was the last session, I was about to say, cheer up, take heart. The next lecturer is already here. Professor Abram Friesen of University of California, Santa Barbara is here. I think you will start lecturing tomorrow, right, at the University of Winnipeg. So cheer up. Don't let your hearts grow weary or your spirits. There are more goodies to come, and it will be getting better all the time. I can commend him to you as a friend and a scholar who for years worked on Anabaptism and Marxism, and he was asked to talk about it so often that once he said to me, I'm not going to speak on that topic one more time, I don't care who asks me, and I don't think that's your subject this time, it's something else. Yeah. I did change the title for this evening somewhat to call it The Place of the Arts in Anabaptism. This lecture had a difficult birth. I hope it was not a stillbirth. Perhaps it was more like a cesarean, where something struggling to be born resisted the normal processes of creation and had to be taken from me when the deadline came. The problem, in part, was the original request for my theme and specific titles, which came so long ago that I had obviously not taken time for any depth study into the areas I was proposing. But even if that request had come only 3 months ago, it might not have made much difference, because there was something in me which made me feel that this was an opportunity to speak to an issue which has occupied me for a long time. It would have been easier, at least in theory, to speak about, the importance of discipline in a believer's church. But this issue of the arts would not let me go for historical, theological, and even personal reasons. This, then, is a very first humble attempt at a statement on this subject, and I again request your counsel and comments and will thank you for them in advance. The Church has always been afraid of the arts, particularly non-Roman Catholics, since the Reformation. We tend immediately to think of Puritanism and its legacy that is with us, but it has been a problem in most traditions in varying degree. In this context, sectarian Mennonitism, to borrow from Trelsa's typology, would obviously be so far to the right as to be off the map. And indeed, George Fox, a group close to Anabaptist Mennonites, the Quakers, saw no place for artists in the meeting or meeting house, and they were disowned. So Anabaptists, too, seem to have held the arts to be worldly and unregenerate, which is part of what we want to test. It strikes me as interesting that Mennonites today, late in this 20th century, are beginning to take a few small or not so small steps in the direction of affirming the arts. We have employed a few graphic artists at our publishing houses and generally appreciate their work, including bulletin covers for Sunday worship services and so on. We commission dramas and underwrite film productions and show the pictures in our sanctuaries. We commission oratorios, cantatas, and hymns and enjoy them. Occasionally, we have dance or mime in connection with our singing, especially among mildly charismatic groups, and even tolerate religious dance at major events like Mennonite World Conference, Wichita 78, especially if it is done by, quote, new Mennonites, unquote, from Asia or Africa. I would call that a giant leap forward. Some would call it backward. As I would the dramatic presentations of a biblical story used as part of devotional preparation at conferences like Bethlehem 83. We don't get upset as much anymore at the new deacon's block antics in Rudy Weeb's and other novels as we used to when the first block came on our screen. We like people to pay huge sums for our quilts at relief sales, but I'm not sure whether these quilts, I'm sure there's an art to them, but I'm not sure whether it falls more in the category of craft than art. I think Mennonites are slowly joining the human race, and I think that's okay. My desire to speak on this issue, however, does not come from these observations about what is already appearing. It comes rather out of a feeling that we have been deprived historically, mostly by ourselves, of a life-giving stream of cultural and spiritual nourishment, a stream which could immeasurably enrich our individual and corporate life, and which could open up new possibilities of being we have never experienced. I'm not saying we have had nothing. Mennonites love to sing and do it well. We have had our literary and Christmas programs with story reenactment and recitation. But in large measure, it is as though we are just on the verge of beginning to use the right side of the brain, not only the left with its rational and dogmatic structures, but the right with its potential for feeling and enjoying, for celebrating our existence and our universe. There are obvious exceptions geographically to the focus that the arts take and the extent, and Winnipeg would certainly be different than many other areas, and I'm aware of that. And in some ways, what I have to say may not fit the Winnipeg situation completely, but I'm speaking to the larger community. First, a word about the function of the arts. The arts, in their visual, graphic, performing, and literary forms, constitute for me a large measure of the creative side of life. Not to create or to enjoy creation and the creativity of others is a kind of dying. In the Genesis account of creation, we read, "In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them, and entrusted everything he had made into their care." As the story unfolds, the new couple rebels against their creator, but God is always there to bring them back, to forgive, and to start over with them. That is the gift of grace. The creative powers within us are a gift of grace, each in their own way, 1 Corinthians 12 and 14. We all have it, but some among us have been given it in a special measure. To call this a gift of grace is the only possible explanation for its origin, a spiritual force given with the gift of life itself. This is why I originally entitled this presentation "The Arts, Sacred or Profane," to draw attention to their divine origin. A primary function of the arts is to communicate. We're familiar with the story about the painter who was asked by a viewer, "What does this painting mean? Could you explain it to me?" And the response, "No, I'm sorry. If I could have said it in words, I would have." This is not to say that the intention of art is necessarily to communicate. At its best, it is much more, but it does communicate. We see this most poignantly as Christians in the Incarnation. In many and various ways, God spoke to of old to our fathers by the prophets, but in these last days he has spoken to us by his Son, through whom he also created the world, Hebrews 1. Music, sculpture, and all the arts stand at the boundary of human dialogue. They want to communicate, and when other means fail, the medium becomes the message. Sir Goethe said, "Did I search for the way so painfully unless to show it to the brothers?" The Incarnation is the epitome of art as communication, if I may say so. Another function of the arts is to span a bridge across the ages. We see this most clearly, perhaps, in the Roman liturgy, which for 1,500 years spanned the ages with an unchanging form in a dead and unchanging language. Or we see twice that time involved in Psalm 23, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." The timeless, classical elements of our culture rest in large measure upon the arts, from the Bible and other literary treasures to architecture, sculpture, Bach, Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, the rock music of our time, the struggle through the ages to tell us by their myriad forms of expression who they were or are. This explains the Renaissance humanist cry ad fontes, back to the sources. What have we inherited? Who are we historically? Artifacts of every kind, from every age, since the beginning of time, contribute immeasurably to our identity. There is often a timeless quality to the arts, which helps them span the bridge of time for us. Yet another function of the arts is to encourage freedom of expression and become a channel for it. The church was the major patron of the arts to the 16th century, and it seems passing strange that artists could work side by side with the Inquisition and survive. There were the iconoclastic tensions in Eastern Christendom in early 8th century, of course, the icon image, but in the end, the use of icons in worship won out, as did their defender, John of Damascus, in 8th century. The influence of this upon Western Christendom was considerable and led to the rapid growth of what later came to be called idolatry, the making and use not only of crucifixes, but lifelike representations of Mary and the saints, in a way far exceeding the flat icons of the East. And yet the artists remained at liberty to do their work, which was not true of theologians questioning official doctrine. The artist was and is, of course, less dogmatic than the theologian. A painting means what you see in it. Many people argued for years with the Associated Seminary's chapel after it was built that it was not a church, that it's an insult to the holy. Some said it looks like a silo, your chapel. Now, it is still speaking to people because the architect had the freedom to put into form what his spirit was saying and hearing what we stood for. Historically, the church has not been known for its emphasis upon freedom, but the arts have been free to use its treasures and have been affirmed. So Karl Barth has said he believes the primary music in heaven will be Mozart, and Mozart was a Freemason. Karl Barth knew that, of course, and he was about as far from Freemasonry as you can get. This freedom of the artist grows out of a need to speak the truth. Why become angry with the seeming chaos of a Picasso painting or the jazz composition that grates upon our senses? If the artist was honest, the result will speak truths to us we may well not wish to hear about the dissonance in our personal and social lives or our culture. Yet there may be healing in the tragedy we see or hear as art. This has been true from Plato on through the medieval mystery plays, Shakespeare's Macbeth, Wagner's Götterdämmerung, to our own Kramer versus Kramer or War Games. The arts inevitably throw light upon the shadows of our existence, and that can lead to catharsis. Let me mention one more function of the arts, one closely related to the freedom we've been discussing. The arts provide channels of release for the feelings and emotions of all of us, whether we are struggling with the angst of being or seeking release from the ecstasy of a mountaintop experience or anything in between. A rough-hewn wooden cross at a retreat camp, a humming of the tune, Just As I Am, Without One Plea, a serene landscape at sunset, a stained glass window with a myriad of motifs we know so well, a poem, a beautiful solo, a singing of the hymn, Lift Your Glad Voices in Triumph on High, For Jesus Has Risen and Man Cannot Die, or singing the Mennonite theme song 606. In all of these, skillful artists have given us channels of release without which life would become unbearable. The effect is often so powerful because genuine art is most often born in anguish and struggles through to victory in a way with which we can identify and embrace. To neglect the arts is to neglect our feelings, I submit. None of us are so emancipated as to be beyond the need for emotive expression and release. It is a gift of the arts to give these channels to us. I think we need the arts to fulfill our destiny as human beings who are made in the image of God. Now, when we talk about rethinking the Anabaptist vision, we here face the serious dilemma of sectarian identity as world-denying, on the one hand, and on the other, the call for a more world-affirming stance. I have a friendly but serious quarrel with my heritage at this point, as I will try to develop a little as we go on. The quarrel I have is that the sectarian ethic has largely cut us off from all the contributions of the arts I have just listed. We have stood mute at the boundary of human dialogue and discouraged it, which, among other things, effectively cut out the evangelistic thrust to this day. The austerity of our worship services, hymn, sermon, prayer, provides no continuity with the past, no bridge, hardly any. We do not use our confessions and hardly know the Apostles' Creed. We have not been known for our belief in freedom of expression and have presumably stifled creative impulses in hundreds of persons over the years and lost many to other traditions. And finally, we have not been noted for our emphasis upon expressing our feelings as Mennonites. Ours is the stiff upper lip, emotions suppressed, no amens or hallelujahs during the service, except more recently in some charismatic congregations. And when I add this all up, it seems to me that I have been deprived of a good deal of what belongs to the fullness of living and human existence. How different Mennonites might be today if these factors had been different. How many fewer splits among groups, how much more natural evangelism might be, and so on. But the counter question, of course, is whether Mennonites would have become so assimilated as not to have a message left to give. My thesis is that this is a false polarity. I argue simply that Christians are called to live in the world, not in little safe ghettos. There was a story told by Chaim Potok in his novel My Name is Asher Lev. It's the story of the clash of two worlds, the story of conservative Judaism and the world of Western secular society as manifested in contemporary art. Asher Lev is the victim of the clash in between these millstones that he was ground in. Asher was reared in a small, devout family within a tightly knit conservative Jewish community in Brooklyn. And all would have gone well there if Asher had not had a gift, and more than a gift, an irresistible passion for art. Asher could not restrain himself from making and looking at art. Eventually, with enormous reluctance, feeling all the while that her child was slipping from their grasp of their love and devotion, Asher's parents consented to let him take lessons from a successful painter in Manhattan, Jacob Kahn. And there the following conversation occurred between Asher and Kahn. In it you will see starkly portrayed the clash of two worlds that I'm talking about. The conversation opens with Kahn speaking. "You have a gift, Asher Lev. You have a responsibility." He stopped in front of me. "Do you know what that responsibility is?" I did not say anything. "Tell me what you think that responsibility is," he said. I was quiet. I did not know what to say. "Do you feel you are responsible to anyone, to anything?" "To my people," I said hesitantly. "What people?" "To Jews." "To Jews," he echoed. "Why do you think you're responsible to Jews?" "All Jews are responsible for one another," I said, quoting the statement from the Talmud my father years ago had quoted to me. "As an artist, you are responsible to Jews?" He seemed angry. "Listen to me, Asher Lev. As an artist, you are responsible to no one and to nothing except to yourself and to the truth as you see it. Do you understand? An artist is responsible to his art. Anything else is propaganda. Anything else is what the communists in Russia call art. I will teach you responsibility to art. Let your Hadover Hasidim teach you responsibility to Jews. Do you understand?" No contemporary Christian who is an artist can read that passage without feeling within ourselves a conflict profoundly similar to what is portrayed here by Potok. The fundamental identity of the Christian in the world is that he is a member of a new nation, a transnational people, the church, the company of those who have committed themselves to being disciples of Jesus Christ. To that people he owes his fundamental earthly loyalty and responsibility, for he sees in that people God's central agency for bringing about his kingdom of justice and peace. As a member of that people, a Christian then comes into contact with a contemporary world of art. Perhaps he has a gift for art, or the arts. Perhaps more than that, he has an irresistible passion for it. Perhaps God made him in such a way that he cannot leave the arts alone. In any case, when he comes into contact with our contemporary secular arts world, he discovers there a jealous God. As anyone knows who is in music, for example, and all the practicing it takes, whether vocal or instrumental, or painting or in any of the arts, including good preaching. Listen to me, Asher Lev. As an artist, you are responsible to no one and to nothing, except to yourself and to the truth as you see it. An artist is responsible to his art. With that introduction, let me turn to a consideration of the Reformation and the arts to begin with. It is likely that the first iconoclasm of the Reformation occurred at Wittenberg in 1521 and 22 as a result of Karlstadt's preaching. Statues and images were being smashed with considerable delight to end what was now considered idolatry. Luther's quick return from the Wartburg and his 8 Invocavit sermons quickly put an end to this, however, and forced Luther further to the right than he might otherwise have gone. Leave everything in a church except what is expressly forbidden in Scripture. So most things stayed in the church. Meanwhile, in Zurich, the Reformation took a different turn under Zwingli. Zwingli had received an excellent education in music and had a very beautiful voice. He seemed to be able to play almost every available instrument and was also a composer. His favorite instrument was the lute. But a new spirit came with the Reformation. When Zwingli applied for the post of people's priest in the great Münster in Zurich, at Zurich in 1518, his friend Meconius wrote, "There are some whom your ready talent for music offends. As a result, they say, to use their words, that you are worldly and sensual." This seemed to be a more serious charge than that he lived in a common law marriage. But he was eventually appointed to the coveted position. Music had always been associated with the church and centered in the Mass. To find it labeled as worldly was a direct result of Reformation preaching upon the people. For over 100 years, German spiritual songs, so-called, written in the vernacular and for only one voice, had become popular with the people, coupled with an equal dislike of monastic chants. The root of this movement away from music lay with Karlstadt. He believed that the Gregorian chant separated the believer from God. In his disputations, he wrote, "The church of which Gregory was head," Gregory, so-called the Great, Gregory the First, "instituted these mumblings, but not the church of which Christ is head," unquote. The background for this statement is primitivism, a return to the pattern of the early church in a way in which we do not find it in Luther. Hence, Zwingli could instruct, in contrast to Luther, that everything should be thrown out of the church except that which was commanded in the Scripture. By 1524, singing had ceased in Zurich worship, and in 1527, the organs were removed. Singing returned in 1598, the organs only in the 19th century. Zwingli did not eliminate music from his private life, even as Cromwell later was not to do, but it had no place in worship. Both Ephesians 5:19 and Colossians 3:16 were interpreted to mean to sing and give thanks in the heart, privately. This position coincides with that of Zwingli's student Conrad Grebel, who wrote to Thomas Mentzer in the letter I quoted this afternoon, September 4, 1524, "If thou wilt abolish the Mass, it cannot be accomplished with German chants, which is thy suggestion, perhaps, or comes from Luther. And do thou drop singing and the Mass, and act in all things according to the Word." In other words, to sing was against the Word, according to Grebel. Luther and Zwingli were not opposed to all art in the church. If a statue aided in worship, Luther believed it ought to be retained. The arts, Luther said, are a gift of God. Stained glass windows were to be retained by all means. But when Zwingli heard the outcry of the people at the removal of certain images, he realized that they had become more than aids to worship, and thereupon renounced all images and statues. Luther continued to believe that religious paintings could be an aid to prayer, even a crucifix, and should be retained. Lucas Cranach helped to fulfill Luther's wish as did Albrecht Dürer, though the two never met, but they were the great artists of that time. There were others who did not agree with Zwingli, particularly John Calvin. To be sure, Calvin rejected all images in worship, Institutes 1-2. Images lead to idolatry and must be abolished, he said. But sculpture, painting, and other arts have their proper place outside the church, as was to be proven later in Puritanism. But Calvin differed from Zwingli in a major aspect, in that he placed the Psalms, singing, into the heart of his worship services. He included this singing under the category of prayer. Since most people were unfamiliar with singing, Calvin had a children's choir practice beforehand and then lead the congregation until all could participate. It seems clear that some of this came about through the influence of Bucer while Calvin was in Strasbourg from 1538 to 41. Writing from Strasbourg, he said, "Yet we do not here condemn speaking and singing, but rather strongly commend them, provided they are associated with the heart's affection." In contrast to Luther, however, who took a familiar street melody and wrote words like "A mighty fortress is our God" to it, Calvin insisted that the text remain biblical, that is, the Psalms. It was through Reformed ministers turned Mennonite, like Hans de Ries and others, who published published a hymnal in 1582, that the Psalms found their way into Mennonite singing. Many of the Psalms were translated from the French rhymed version into the Dutch by Peter de Tenis and then used by the Mennonites. And now the arts in Anabaptist context. Original Swiss Anabaptism, that is, Grebel, Mons, Blaurock, Reublin, Breitli, Hubmaier, was not separatist in intention, as we've said in these days. Force of circumstance led to the January 21, 1525 baptismal service, but even this was not the final break, nor was it intended to be that, over against the Hutterite chronicler's account. This was still the Anabaptism which came out of humanism and its Bible study circles. Decisive separation came with the monastically influenced Schleitheim of 1527, especially Article 4. "We have been united concerning the separation that shall take place from the evil and the wickedness which the devil has planted in the world. Simply is this, that we have no fellowship with them and do not run with them in the confusion of their abominations. So it is. Since all who have not entered the obedience of faith and have not united themselves with God so that they will do his will. Now there is nothing else in the world and all creation than good or evil, believing and unbelieving, darkness and light, the world and those who are come out of the world." This is what has been called the sectarian black and white world. A parallel can be found in Peter Walput's writings in the Gross Artikelbuch, and, of course, in the writings of the Martyr's Mirror. It is a radical statement of the doctrine of the two kingdoms or two worlds. This frame of reference was to shape much of Upper Rhine Anabaptism, but we note differences arising among the Hutterites, for example. They seem to have been rather creative in their pottery work, the Habana pottery, which is known to this day, in the crafts and trades learned by their young men, and which enabled them to combine their work with evangelism as they traveled about practicing their craft, and also in the way barber surgeons and others among them managed to maintain significant relations with people of very different theological convictions. Aside from a different political context in Moravia, I attribute this creativity to their Gelassenheit. In a completely different setting, the Ausbund hymnal of the 1560s, originating in a Passau prison in 1540 and still in use, must certainly be considered a work of art. So too must the engineering skills of Pilgrim Marpeck in Augsburg and Strasbourg until his death in 1556, and the drainage systems created by Mennonites from the lowlands in the Vistula River region in the 16th century. But these illustrations take us too far from our theme. The experience of Mennonites with the arts in the Netherlands is vastly different from what we have described in the Upper Rhine region. Relative toleration came soon after mid-16th century, and with it a significant measure of freedom and autonomy. It is also clear, however, that the lowlands represented a very different cultural milieu after the Spanish occupation, much more cosmopolitan and international than the Swiss and Upper German areas. The Dutch Mennonite movement cannot be understood as a derivative of the Swiss, which it also is not, but as a sui generis movement amidst the turmoil of 1530 to the collapse of Münster in 1535, nourished by roots in sacramentarianism, Erasmus, and the Brethren of the Common Life, and becoming almost a majority movement in the land until 1555. It appears that Dutch Anabaptists were more a part of their native culture, even if they were counterculture, than in other places. They were always at home in the land and considered it theirs. They were citizens of the land, and in a way we find infrequently elsewhere in Mennonite history. Is relative affluence necessary for a flowering of the arts? Fraktur can be done with no more than a pen and paper. Yet by 1600, the correlation in the Netherlands seemed clear. The 17th century became the great creative period among the Dutch Mennonites, but they were part of a national movement. Painting led that era. Karel van Mander, a Mennonite, is recognized as beginning the Protestant phase of the arts in the Netherlands in his paintings. He also wrote hymns and a history of art entitled Het Schilderboek, the volume on art. Lambert Jacobs, who died 1636, was also an early Mennonite painter, followed by many others, including his son Abraham Jacobs van den Tempel, Govert Flink, who died 1660, Michel Jans van Mierenveld, 1641, Solomon van Ruysdael, died 1670, and many others. Rembrandt, who died in 1669, was not a Mennonite, but kept close fellowship with them and was frequently influenced by them and painted them. This same period also gave birth to extensive devotional, historical, and other literary writings. We think, for example, of Peter Peters' Way to the City of Peace, first published in 1625. This was preceded by hymnals and the 1615 martyrology of Hans de Ries, followed by the well-known von Bracht's Martyr's Mirror of 1660, for the second edition of which in 1685, Jan Luyken supplied 104 engravings. He is said to have produced 3,275 engravings, as well as numerous poems. The national poet of the Netherlands, or Shakespeare, was Joost van den Vondel, a member and for time deacon of the Waterlander Mennonite Church. When in his mid-50s he joined the Roman Catholic Church, in part, it seems, because of the simplicity of Mennonite worship and the austerity of their meeting house, the lack of aesthetics, which failed to meet his personal needs, apparently. By late 17th century, many Dutch Mennonites were becoming wealthy. With leisure time and money came interest in aesthetics in a way that the martyr would have thought sacrilegious. A Reformed critic, J. van Effen, reports a conversation about the year 1730 with a Doopsgezind or Mennonite, in which the latter shares that he has acquired a specially beautiful mantelpiece for the fireplace in his new house. Common marble had been too ordinary for him, and the famous architect he had engaged would not have it either. He had sent the blueprints to Dresden in the hope of having it made there from Saxon marble. I did not specify what it should cost, the Dokshuzen said, since I wanted it to be as expensive as I could get it, and I am happy that one cannot find another like it in our land. To this, Van Effen replied that he might well be happy with it only until another Dokshuzen would hear about it, in which case work would begin immediately to surpass it. It is true, Van Effen continues with some irony, that they still continue to show some ethical simplicity in their manner of dress. They avoid loud colors. But, he adds, this is only external and means nothing. For the most expensive silks, linen, and woolen goods to be had in the world are found in their homes. If a soup is prepared by them, it must have a specific fish, size of fish, caught in such and such water, at such and such depth, to be edible. Nothing tastes good to them unless it costs handfuls of money. It seems, Van Effen adds, that sea and land, farms, gardens, vineyards, and everything must combine to satisfy their exotic tastes. That's the Mennonites, or Dokshuzen. Some of the Dokshuzen challenged this report. One asserted that there still were people among them who followed the teachings of the fathers, which Van Effen admits, but then he adds, not very many. Another argued that this lifestyle was not only being lived by them, which Van Effen also admits, but reminds him of his particular heritage. More poignantly, he reminds him of the envy they are arousing among the population. Could this be the beginning of a great fall? Van Effen continues by describing the events of the Reformation period, how conquering troops had destroyed Dutch resistance, burnt their churches, and persecuted the clergy. But, he adds, the Dokshuzen, or Mennonites, were immune. They had no land, no homes, no property, no churches. They were fleeing from place to place to escape persecution. No one defended them, and they themselves did not use weapons in their defense. Their persecutors finally gave up and left. Suddenly, in this historical drama, according to Van Effen, one of the persecutors returns and calls to the others that he knows a way that will indeed destroy the Mennonites after all. When they ask him what method that might be, he advises that the Dokshuzenden, or Mennonites, be given complete freedom to do what they wish to do in business and commerce in the world, and he predicts that soon their hearts will begin to be tied to the things of earth. Their love for godly things will die. They will build big houses and farms and drag the world after them. And alas, he adds, that is what came to pass. The following rhyme, of which I have made a rough translation, was part of this. And it doesn't rhyme in the English in which I rendered it. And if the smallest part of a dress is not right, the tailor must take it all apart and change it. In brief, first the Mennonites were, nothing I say is more the truth, in the world, but now the world is in the midst of them. A German Lutheran pastor visiting the Mennonites tended to confirm some parts of this report, saying, in these lands the Dokshuzenden, or Mennonites, are frequently regarded highly and belong among the richest people of the land. If these people were forced to leave this land, its wealth and commerce would suffer irreparable loss. He adds that they are not inclined to take second place to any group in the land, internally and externally, and claim the privilege of the land as do all others. Those who would like to see a negative correlation between wealth and the arts will find comfort in the fact that this was a period of spiritual and numerical decline among them also. Yet the correlation is a complex issue. In any case, I must report that some 100 congregations, Mennonite congregations, closed their doors during the 18th century, about one a year. It appears that were about 160,000 people in the Mennonite camp in 1700, and 26,900 in 1808, 100 years later, and only 15,326 in 1837. In 1708, Harlem had 3,000 members. A little over 100 years later, they had 488. Horn had 450 members in 1695, 212 in 1747, 119 in 1845. Flissingen had 230 in 1660, 99 in 1757, and 22 70 years later. The province of Friesland went from a Mennonite population of about 20,000 in 1666 to fewer than 13,000 100 years later. An increase was experienced in the 19th century, and statistics are more reliable. 41,000 children, 41,800 in 1859, including children, 58,000 in 1899, 62,000 in 1930, 67,000 in 1947, and then 25,000 in 1978. A loss of 41,000, nearly 42,000 since 1947. This is not the place to analyze this data, except to comment that there does not seem to have been a strong worship or theological tradition which exposed potential members to the attractiveness of their heritage. It was an age of individualism. Their daughter settlements in the Vistula Delta grew rapidly, necessitating emigration to Russia. Growth in the Upper Rhine region remained slow, mitigated by emigration to North America. Well, we've gone beyond the initial Anabaptist time span in connection with his Dutch experience, largely to present a case study of how the arts did flourish in the context of a sectarian theology. This would seem to negate my earlier indictment against sectarianism, but in actual fact, these artists drew upon other cultural and spiritual resources also to sustain them. We need to confess that in keeping with the initial Reformation thrust against the arts, the Anabaptists too shared the misgivings. The same misgivings, to wit, more than a millennium of misuse bordering on idolatry in the church and a consequent rejection of that tradition. A Puritanism that wanted to the church holy and simple, a reverence for Scripture that took seriously the Dominical injunction against graven images, and a strong reliance on the inner voice of the Spirit rather than upon externals. A church-world dualism was the ground out of which this came forth. Then what about Mennonites and the arts, finally? When we respond to this question, we bring with us some of the same arguments found in Anabaptism, but others can be added. We referred earlier to the sectarian ethic. One of the values of this ethic, as most Mennonites know, is the importance of work and self-sufficiency. Until recently, if a Mennonite wanted, say, to paint, parents would ask how they intended to make a living. For girls or young women, teaching and nursing could tide them over until marriage. But for boys, impossible. It was all right for persons who were ill. And I heard some of that about your brother Cornelius in Paraguay. Well, he isn't well in health, so he can paint. That's all right. Or old brother Johannes Janssen in Brazil. He's old, he can't do much else, so let him paint. That's okay. Or people who were different, like Heinrich Peters, Nechako. Well, he can't do much anyway, so he can make these Frakturschriften. Or perhaps as a hobby for a teacher or minister, but not for others. It's not real work. And then only landscapes, not portraits. Today things are changing. One can do commercial art to supplement income. One can even become a freelance writer for the church and remain alive, barely. Or if a real need is identified, as when Heinrich Peters supplied fracture drawings for the hundreds of barren walls of the Paraguay settlers, they needed something to hang on their little walls, and Peter supplied that need. Because Mennonites love music and hymnody and singing, it would appear that musicians have an easier time of it among them. That may be true, though the new is often not received enthusiastically. Church school teachers are now paid more than Christopher Dock received, and most ministers now receive some kind of salary, but not the choir directors or organists or pianists. They're taken for granted, with appreciation, of course. Yet a good choir director works as hard at his/her work as a minister does at his/her sermon. Often the skills required are equal. It is strange that Mennonites and others will pay $5 or $10 to hear a professional violinist, say Itzhak Perlman, for example, but not support their own budding Perlmans or orchestras. We are not yet at home with the arts. They belong neither to our world of work nor to our world of faith. In business, we think we can be in the world without being of the world. But in the arts, trust is still lacking. The world is still bad, if not sectarian black, then at least gray and white. So then what? Mennonites, like all people, need the arts to keep on growing in self-understanding and in faith. The arts can speak where words fail. Where is the Mennonite artist who can build a meeting house simply yet creatively, more than this will seat 400 people? Mennonites need mirrors to see themselves, warts and all. Mennonites need to learn to play and to laugh. Where would our divisions have ended up historically if we had had more of a sense of humor? Read the Martyr's Mirror. They even had humor under torture and at the stake. We've often lost it. We need the liberal arts. The need for liberal arts has never been greater than in our increasingly scientific and technological age. Clyde Kilby, an artist at Wheaton College, believes that only the arts can bring alive our imagination. And he would add, what is life without imagination? No dreams or fantasies or visions, just cold logic if it's not for the arts. And I quote a few sentences. Evangelicals don't think about how imagination and the spirit relate. They're so intent on preaching, knowing Bible lessons, and applying Christianity that I think they frequently lead people away from the truth. So far as I can judge, they do more harm than good. I've been an advocate all these years for listening to what the Spirit tells us about imagination. Imagination will open doors within ourselves and to others for a richer, fuller life if we only give it a chance. I'm not a literary critic, but I think there is a lot of imagination and liberating humor, for example, in Arnold Dick's writings, like Copen Buo Forno Toronto, or De Fria. Somehow it was okay to do that in the lowly Plattdeutsch. And some stories can really only be told in that low German, let's admit that. But his high German writings are more polite and sophisticated, I think. You take the low German medium if you want to get down to that level. And that's where I think he gave us a wrong model. What I identified earlier as a friendly quarrel with the sectarian tradition is history. But there are things we can do today without betraying our heritage. In this effort, we need our artists, our writers, academicians, and all of us, not least our ministers. Just as a congregation has a right to expect that a sermon be the person's creative best, with room for some foul balls now and then, so our hymnals, our publication, can lead the way. Since art in most forms has normally been suspect among Mennonites in the past, artists have not received a great deal of affirmation when they need it most. They often feel lonely and misunderstood. We can speak up against the use of pseudo-art, like Solomon's Head of Christ, or Hoffman's Christ in Gethsemane, which has our Lord look like he came from a Sunday school picnic, when in fact, according to the scriptures, quote, his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down upon the ground, Luke 22. I'm not advocating putting Grünewald's Isenheim altar into our churches, but we can do better than we have. Some people consider Picasso's Guernica, with its broken bodies and chaos, one of the world's greatest statements against war. But Picasso and probably Mennonites don't mix, seems to me. We can all think of creative ways to further the arts among us. I may add, however, that there is a Picasso out here in the hall. It's not the Guernica, but there is a Picasso hanging out here. And I think that's great. We can all think of creative ways to further the arts among us. It is my hope that this presentation can help to stimulate dialogue. Above all, we need to leave out black and white worlds and seek contemporary ways of nonconformity, which I think is one of the basic issues, while affirming the good in society around us and of which we are an integral and willing part.